This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
It's the Media Buzz Meter with Howard Kurtz.
I am so friggin' mad at Google Docs, which I switched to because Microsoft Word was an S show. And they have a lot of good features, but yesterday, for example, I was making a long series of notes for the podcast, actually. Hit the wrong button, and suddenly every single paragraph that I had there had a bullet. And it just made it very hard to read. So in a normal world, you would feel like you'd go back to that button and it would say delete or undo. But no, the tech bros don't do it that way. And I tried like 15 different things. I actually then changed it to from bullets to little squares, which didn't help either. I had to use Google, ironically, to figure out how to delete it. And I never was able to do it. I did some of it manually. So it always is something when you want to get rid of something. You can't say not now, undo, cancel, or you got to go to, you know, through three menus and know the secret password. So I was not pleased. I got more important things to do. Anyway, is today the day? I say this because you know what I'm talking about. The grand jury didn't meet yesterday. Nobody knows why. The grand jury is meeting at noon Eastern today. It's not clear whether there's one more witness or not. So probably if Manhattan DA Alvin Bragg is going to bring this indictment against Donald Trump, it will either be later today or next week. So no less a media critic than Howard Stern is saying this. I was watching MSNBC. They were going effing berserk, you know, with Trump potentially being arrested. Oh my God, he says, it's the same discussion over and over again. And it's true, you see the same people over and over again, like every hour. They go, it's very possible that President Trump will be indicted, according to... And then they all come on the air and they're all discussing whether or not Trump's going to be indicted. I go, you know what? Why don't you sit tight and wait and see instead of like speculating as if cable would ever do that. So Robin Quivers says, well, it's like a sporting event. You know, they treat politics like sports. When something like the Super Bowl is coming up, you have 2 weeks to discuss what's going to happen. And Howard says, listen, they got to fill 24 hours a day. They got plenty to do. But, you know, it's crazy. The thing I love is that everyone's talking about Trump, Trump, Trump. And he said yesterday was the day he was going to be arrested. But Trump is the one who said he was going to be arrested. And they all believe him that he was going to be arrested. By the way, when I mentioned the other day that Stern was sort of backing John Stewart for president, the comparison he made, and I thought of this because I watched another episode the other day, was to Vladimir Zelensky, who started a sitcom in which he played the president of Ukraine. He was an actor. He was a comedian. And the whole premise of this series is that Ukraine is so utterly corrupt that even a fresh-faced guy coming in trying to root out that corruption finds it everywhere, including in his own family. So that's the analogy. Aaron Sorkin of West Wing fame and many other shows has just revealed to the New York Times that he suffered a stroke. This is last November, 2 months before this Broadway show he was working on called Camelot was set to begin. And he said his blood pressure was so high that you're supposed to be dead. For about a month afterwards, Sorkin was slurring words. He had trouble typing. He was discouraged from flying for a few weeks and until recently couldn't sign his name. Those issues are now behind him. The main lingering effect is he still can't really taste food. And Sorkin is quoted as saying, mostly it was a loud wake-up call. I thought I was one of those people who could eat whatever he wanted, smoke as much as he wanted, and it's not going to affect me. Boy, was I wrong. There was a time when I was concerned I was not ever going to be able to write again. And I wasn't going to be able to continue writing Camelot. So he was keeping this quiet and decided he would talk to the New York Times about it because, quoting him, if it'll get one person to stop smoking, then it'll be helpful. For a long time, he said he was smoking two packs a day. So there's this whole Beethoven mystery that I find both fascinating and macabre. Here's the Wall Street Journal write-up. So apparently before Beethoven died, people, friends of his, I guess, as keepsakes, cut locks of his hair. And some of that has survived. And so researchers were examining it to see, well, is this what caused his deafness? Was this what caused his stomach pain? They found genetic risk for liver disease and evidence of hepatitis B infection, which can affect the liver. It didn't have to necessarily be drinking. And it's just, apparently there's this whole industry using the hair to construct a DNA genome of Ludwig van Beethoven. Centuries later. So there were a bunch of people who had a common ancestor. And that person was Aert van Beethoven, born in 1535. This goes on a while. They compared the Y chromosome of Beethoven's genome against that of five living men from the van Beethoven line. A male's Y chromosome remains nearly identical to his father's and is passed down through generations. However, the five living van Beethovens were not related to Ludwig. What happened? Well, I'll tell you what happened. Between the birth of Aert, that's A-E-R-T, van Beethoven's son around 1572 in Belgium, and the birth of the famous composer 200 years later in Bonn, the father of a Beethoven wasn't the child's biological parent. The living van Beethoven were shocked to hear that they weren't really biologically related to the composer, although they were still in his sort of genealogical line. Beethoven never married and has no legal descendants. Scholars have suggested that the person he referred to in his letters as immortal beloved was a married woman and that her daughter was Beethoven's child. Her daughter died without having children, according to scholars. So you need to know all these things. I mean, Beethoven is a giant. He's huge. And then there was a false alarm with one lock of hair that turned out to be a woman's. I mean, it's a whole detective mystery. And the fact that this could even be studied and available to draw conclusions centuries later is kind of mind-blowing. Okay, story number one. So the new news here is a federal appeals court ruling yesterday that Donald Trump's lawyer, who was involved in the handling of the classified documents at Mar-a-Lago, had to answer a grand jury's questions and give up documents to prosecutors. The ruling by this judge was a victory for the special counsel, that's Jack Smith, overseeing the investigation. And Trump was trying to stop his lawyer, whose name is Evan Corcoran, from handing over what are likely to be dozens of documents to investigators. This is shedding new light on what Trump did or didn't do with all those documents at Mar-a-Lago. The debate was whether or not Corcoran could be forced to provide information when he was Trump's lawyer. So prosecutors have been focused on one document that Corcoran drafted last spring saying that a diligent search had been conducted at Mar-a-Lago and no further classified material remained there. And that turned out to be false because when you had that court-approved raid on the Palm Beach property, they found many more classified documents. So the case also involves attorney-client privilege. As I mentioned the other day, usually that protects any discussion between a lawyer and a client unless there is something called the crime fraud exception. And that allows prosecutors to break through attorney-client privilege when they think that the legal advice or legal services have been used in furthering a crime. In other words, you can't be somebody's lawyer, act as a crook, and then say, well, I can't testify because I'm his lawyer. I'm sure Corcoran maybe wishes he hadn't got involved in this, just an educated guess. He had appeared before the grand jury once, but he asserted the privilege to limit the questions he would have to answer or any records he'd have to turn over. The judge in the case found the government had made a prima facie case. Isn't it fascinating how much Latin there is in the law? You know, caveat emptor. And all kinds of other phrases. So a prima facie case showing that the former president committed criminal violations. And that's a lower bar. That doesn't mean that Trump committed any crimes or that the prosecutors have enough evidence to charge it. It just means another step in the process. Some other stuff related to the former president. Got talked about on Fox quite a bit yesterday. On The Five, Jesse Waters said, you know, what Alvin Bragg wants is a mugshot. And you're going to see it in every newspaper, and it's going to scare Republican donors. And they're going to throw money at a guy that's been indicted, been booked, have been fingerprinted. A lot of these corporate guys don't want to throw money at a guy like Trump. Then Greg Gutfeld made what I thought was a pretty trenchant observation. He said, you know, in terms of Trump's first election, it wasn't us. It wasn't Fox or The Five that elected Trump in 2016. It was the very same people pushing this, meaning talking up the Stormy Daniels case, which, by the way, has been criticized by people on the left, too, including CNN's Van Jones. And straight journalists who say, look, this is a weak case, this is a lousy case, this is not an important case, this should not be the first or only, who knows, criminal charge against Trump. Gutfeld going on to say it was the Morning Joes and the Discord orgy, I have to look that up, on CNN that were basically just shoved all the oxygen to Trump, which is exactly what happened this week. And we, for some reason, our muscles were not in use and we weren't used to it. You know, that's the thing. It's the oxygen. When Trump is dominating the media oxygen and no one else can get a breath or barely, it's almost always good for him. Now, in the long run, looking ahead to a general election, is it a good thing that Donald Trump will have been indicted? No, not in my view. I think that will turn off a bunch of swing voters that otherwise he might be able to get. Does it mean that his base will rally around him even more tightly and see him as a victim of deep state persecution? Yes, but they're with him no matter what. Which leads me to what Laura Ingraham said last night. She used her television platform to offer this advice. Now, if I were Trump and running his campaign, I'd strongly urge him to stop talking about 2020. It's over. Enough. Marinating in old claims of election fraud will not win over a single voter in any state that he needs to win in 2024. And of course she's right. Why Trump continues to pound away at the grievance he has over the 2020 election, which now seems like fairly ancient history to a lot of people. He needs to win independence. He needs to win suburban women. And I think regardless of what their view might be on stolen election charges that have now been repeated for over 2 years, it's looking backwards. It's not, you know, Trump always plays to his base, but I think one of the reasons he lost in 2020, in addition to the pandemic, was that he doesn't do much to expand his base. Now, maybe he'll take this advice, maybe not. But it's interesting that it came from Laura Ingraham, and I've already seen it replayed on other channels. Hey, let's pause right there. The buzz meter continues right after this.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network, subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.
Story number two. I wanted to start here with a column by Ross Douthat in the New York Times, looking at what really are the pros and cons politically of Trump being indicted, if indeed he is indicted, in the Stormy case. Well, Ross looks at the coverage and says that the use of the phrase novel legal theory in descriptions of the case is not encouraging. Well, that's true. If you haven't brought this kind of case against anybody else, it looks to even neutral parties, let alone, you know, critics on the right, that this is something that the selected Democrat, Bragg, cooked up so he could get Donald Trump. And, you know, I've never understood, why did he drop the case a year ago? You know, in terms of, you say, well, maybe he had more evidence. No, it's the same people, Michael Cohen and others, whose credibility will be quite tested at the trial, if there is a trial. So Douthat says, the doubts raised by writers and pundits not known for their sympathy to Trump are also not encouraging, or the fact that we have a precedent of a presidential candidate, I remember this vividly, indicted over payments to Riel Hunter. She was the woman who was sort of his mistress and ended up carrying his child on the campaign trail when he ran for president. And that yielded an acquittal on one count and a hung jury on the rest. Was he using money to pay her off? I mean, he was using money to pay her off, but did that amount to illegal? It's parallel to hush money, except there's a baby involved. The Bill Clinton-Monica Lewinsky precedent is a little less legally relevant because it involved perjury instead of campaign finance law. But the Clinton scandals, this is key, I think. The Clinton scandals established a general principle that presidents are above the law as long as the law-breaking involved minor infractions covering up tawdry sex. If a potential Trump prosecution requires overturning that principle, then prosecutors might as well appear in court wearing Democratic Party campaign paraphernalia. The effect will be the same. I mean, if you can't run for president and cover up a little tawdry sex, what's this world come to? And, you know, it's true. I mean, he makes a good point that this would seem to be of use to the Democratic Party. Now, Douthat goes on to say, it doesn't have to benefit Trump politically to make a prosecution unwise or reckless. An indictment could hurt him at the polls and still be a very bad idea, meaning from a Democratic point of view, I believe. Setting a precedent that will pressure Republican prosecutors to indict Democratic politicians on similarly doubtful charges, establishing a pattern of legal revenge against the out-of-power party. So nobody will be able to have sex in any party because somebody might indict them. I mean, I'm exaggerating for effect, but in any event. Even a partisan-seeming indictment won't do anything to make Trump more popular with the independent voters who swing presidential elections, as I believe I was just talking about. At the same time, even an airtight indictment would be regarded as persecution by Trump's most devoted fans, and that is true. If they cite him for jaywalking, they'll go crazy. So whether or not there's a wave of MAGA protests now, you would expect the spectacle of a prosecution to help mobilize and motivate his base in 2024. And so finally, the column says that certain Trumpists have been making this argument for a while, and this seems to confirm it. There's nothing the establishment fears more than a Trump restoration, that, quote, they can't let him back in, as former Trump White House official Michael Anton put it last year. So if you care most about ideological conflict, it doesn't matter if you don't love him, as his true supporters do. Where Trump stands, there you must stand as well. Interesting. And the former president hitting back just about on a daily basis against the governor of Florida, who's finally said some tough things about him, although officially Ron DeSantis is not a candidate yet. Ron DeSanctimonious is not working for the people of Florida as he should be. He is too busy chatting with ratings-challenged TV host from England, a ratings-challenged TV host, desperately trying to rescue his failing campaign. But it's my fault. I put him there. This is Trump's conceit. I mean, DeSantis was struggling in 2018, got an endorsement from Trump, and won the governorship. Of course, he's since won it in a landslide on his own. But the reference, in case you didn't get it, is to Piers Morgan. And I don't know what, there may have been multiple reasons why, of all the people that DeSantis would sit down with, he would choose Piers Morgan as opposed to an American journalist. Doesn't like many American journalists, I would quickly add. But it particularly gets under Trump's skin because Piers and Donald were friendly for years and years. I mean, long before even Donald got into politics. And then they had a series of falling outs, going back to 2020 and then January 6th. And then finally there was a sit down last year where Piers claimed Trump got angry and walked out. Trump said no, he was just done. But clearly no love lost now between the two men. Story three is kind of chilling because beyond what I'm about to tell you, the implications for journalism, for the internet, are just hard to fathom because it brings up a situation where you can't believe your own eyes. You've undoubtedly heard about deepfakes and how easy it is to produce very realistic-looking photos that are completely bogus, that are just garbage, using AI technology. So Washington Post starts out by saying, and maybe you've seen these pictures floating around, and we'll get to the punchline in a minute. Elliot Higgins is the founder of an open-source investigative outlet, Bellingcat, was reading about the expected indictment of Trump. There he is again. And so he turned to an AI art generator, giving simple prompts like Donald Trump falling down while being arrested. And he got these images. And he shared the results. Trump surrounded by police officers. Trump running away from police officers. He shared it on Twitter. He wrote, making pictures of Trump getting arrested while waiting for Trump's arrest. So it wasn't like he was actively trying to deceive anybody. He labeled it as something that he was just doing in his spare time. I was just mucking about, Higgins told the Washington Post. I thought maybe five people would retweet it. 2 days later, his post depicting an event that never happened, kind of a key detail, right? Never happened, had been viewed nearly 5 million times. I believe that's called viral. And it's a case study in how sophisticated these images are. And I'm not saying all the 5 million people thought this was true and it happened, but the ease in which you can do this and deploy these images and unleash them on the internet, whether you think 5 people are going to retweet it or 5 million, makes pretty clear that there aren't really any standards here. I mean, what do you do if you're not engaged actively in some kind of scam where you're using fake images to try to make money or rip somebody off? Do the images get banned on social media? Do you get penalized? How does anybody know that what they're looking at is real? So Twitter didn't respond to for comment. That's because Elon's laid off the whole comm staff. Spokeswoman for Meta pointed to examples of the images, which quickly migrated, shall we say, from Twitter to other social media, being fact-checked on its services, including the photo-sharing app Instagram. YouTube and TikTok did not immediately respond. So I guess on Facebook, they put up a thing that said, missing context. Yeah, that's for sure. Independent fact-checkers say information in this post could mislead people. Could mislead people. That was just in one post by somebody who's got 3,000 followers. But one of the images was left untouched when shared by a user with 3 times as many followers. In an unprecedented turn of events, former President Donald Trump was arrested and escorted to federal prison, wrote the user who describes himself as a blogger and former U.S. infantryman. The shocking image of Trump with officers holding both of his hands quickly circulated on social media. So, unlike the original guy from Bellingcat, this dude was, hey, I'm going to scam everybody, and a lot of people are going to click on this and say, holy cow, I went out for lunch for an hour, I come back, and Trump's already been arrested. So the only penalty for Higgins, the guy who first did this, is that the art tool that he used, it's called Midjourney, very popular, closed his account without any explanation of what rule he violated. There's more to this. When far-right activist Jack Posobiec tweeted a video seeming to show President Biden announcing a military draft, you can see now why this is not just for laughs, seeming to announce a military draft to answer Russia's offensive in Ukraine, he described it as a sneak preview of things to come. Now, Twitter slapped a label on it, saying the video shown is a deepfake created with the aid of artificial intelligence. Posobiec, speaking at CPAC, defended the tactic. He said, I made a deepfake of Joe Biden. It got a little bit of attention. He said that, yeah, I got pushback from some fact checkers who asked him, how can you do that? Why would you make something like this? Screw them all, he said, of fact checkers and mainstream news outlets. So you can see the problem. You can absolutely positively see the problem, which is there are some people who do this for fun. There's some people do this to be deceptive. There's inevitably going to be, and it's going to get better and better. There are never going to be people that are doing it to wreak havoc. And I don't know. I got to think about this. Should images that are fake be kicked off of Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, etc.? Or is a warning label enough? Why can you not allowed to lie, although there's always this great debate about what constitutes, air quotes, misinformation in text, but you put up a phony picture and that's okay and you just get a little slap on the wrist? I don't know. I will think more about it.
Hey, let's pause right there. The buzz meter continues right after this.
Story number four. One of the most important members of Congress right now is Jim Comer. He's the Republican who chairs the House Oversight Committee, which is spending a lot of time investigating the Biden family. So the Times has a pretty interesting profile of him because my impression is that he's serious about these investigations, but he pulls the trigger a little too soon, by which I mean, you know, he'll go on TV and say, well, we have found three more members of the Biden family who have received checks, but we don't know, and he doesn't know, what is that for? Could it be rent? I think Hunter Biden put out a statement saying he had partnered on some venture. I think that was, you know, trying to hook up some business in China with two or three of his relatives, I forget. And therefore, that was an innocent explanation. So usually, maybe in today's world, you don't do this anymore. You just go and on Fox and throw it out. But when you read this Times profile, and, you know, he's becoming a star, particularly to conservative voters. And he says that Biden's and his family's business activities with China posed a threat to national security. He implied there was a connection between Biden improperly holding onto classified documents when he was a private citizen and his son Hunter receiving a diamond from a Chinese tycoon. He also lamented, and this sounded kind of tasteless, if you ask me, that Bo Biden, the president's late son who died of cancer in 2015, he lamented that he was never investigated. So the interesting thing here, though, is his background, which is he's from Kentucky. He voted on January 6th to certify Joe Biden's victory. He was a favorite among Democrats in the Kentucky legislature. And now, the way the Times puts it, he's part of the Republican war machine. An example of what it takes to thrive in the MAGA universe. It also underscores the cutthroat instincts of Comer, who presents himself as an affable country boy of limited abilities, but who has proved to be a methodical and transactional political operator willing to go to great lengths to crush his adversaries. For example, during his campaign for governor in 2015, which I gather he lost, facing allegations of abuse from an ex-girlfriend who also said he had taken her to get an abortion, Comer worked to discredit a blogger on the claims and a campaign rival he believed was behind them, leaking private emails between the two. Comer denied the woman's charges, lost the race anyway. The Times, this is the intimidation paragraph. I always like to point this out when a news organization is telling everybody else in the biz, don't even try to match this. We've put in too much time. The Times spent 6 hours interviewing Comer, spoke to more than 30 people close to him throughout his life. Comer says this is not, that his committee is not a vehicle for political vengeance against Biden, but it's a matter of legislative oversight. And when the tables are turned, the Democrats claim the same thing when they're investigating a Republican administration. But, you know, he likes having a reputation for bipartisanship. There are photos of him. I hope these are not deepfakes of him and Biden in his office. Coming back to that race. Comer says that he was limited in how much he could control other members like Marjorie Taylor Greene. He said, it's hard for a coach to tell LeBron James what he's doing wrong. And then there's praise from him, from various Republican luminaries. Going back to the 2015 race in Kentucky, it turns out that there was a story in the Lexington Herald Leader in which those leaked emails suggested a coordination between the blogger and the husband of the running mate of one of Comer's opponents. And there were rumors that Comer had swiped the emails from the server for the husband's former law firm and leaked them. And he tells the Times, yeah, I did it. He admits for the first time that he did it. So this is a guy who knows how to play hardball. Let's put it that way. Number five, I'm surprised that this hasn't happened already, given that, what was it? I don't know, 3-4 months ago, none of us had ever heard of ChatGPT, or we knew about artificial intelligence, obviously, but not the way it's being used now. So when ChatGPT exploded in popularity, David Rosato decided to test its potential for bias. A data scientist in New Zealand, he subjected the chatbot to a series of quizzes. And according to this paper that he published and quoted by the New York Times, on more than a dozen tests, the chat bot was liberal, progressive, democratic. So this guy in New Zealand decides, well, we better create one that reflects our view since he's conservative. He called the experiment right-wing GPT, not exactly subtle. And so now it's become another front in the political and cultural wars. Well, I have seen stories that talk about how particularly the ChatGPT that Microsoft is backing do seem to lean to the left. And I can see, you know, the larger problem here is it's the old garbage in, garbage out. I mean, we've learned the limitations. They can only deal with about, these chatbots can only deal with about 4,000 words at a time. The newest version is going to be 8,000 words, but that's not that many words that every time you do a new search or have a new encounter, it starts from zero. Anyway, a advisor and board member for the Allen Institute for Artificial Intelligence, Oren Etzioni, is quoted as saying, "This isn't a hypothetical threat. This is an imminent, imminent threat." Conservatives have accused ChatGPT's creator, the San Francisco company OpenAI, which, by the way, included at the time and still includes as an investor Elon Musk, of designing a tool that they say reflects the liberal values of its programmers. Not exactly a difficult stretch when you think about this company being in San Francisco. So the program once wrote an ode to President Biden, but it declined to write a similar poem about Donald Trump, saying it needed to be neutral. Well, what kind of artificial intelligence crap is that? ChatGPT told one user that it was never morally acceptable to use a racial slur, even in a hypothetical situation in which doing so could stop a devastating nuclear bomb. Here's Elon. I didn't realize he was in the piece. He has accused ChatGPT of being woke and pledged to build his own version. Well, competition is good. But, you know, it's just so typical of our politics and our society that this is becoming an issue. But, you know, on the other hand, if the ChatGPTs that were created over the last few years all seem to give lots of conservative answers, I'm sure the liberal media and the liberal establishment and the liberal academia would be going bonkers. That's a technical term. Gab, a social network with an avowedly Christian nationalist bent, has become a hub for white supremacists and extremists, has promised to release AI tools with the ability to generate content freely without the constraints of liberal propaganda wrapped tightly around its code. And the founder of Gab, Andrew Torba, says Silicon Valley is investing billions to build these liberal guardrails to neuter the AI into forcing their worldview in the face of users and present it as reality. We don't intend to allow our enemies to have the keys to the kingdom this time around. So now, in the future, by which I mean, you know, maybe 2 weeks from now, you get to choose your own chatbot. I mentioned yesterday Google is creating one as well, and I've signed up to be a beta tester. And you can pick one that you like on all kinds of aesthetic or efficiency grounds, and you can pick one that you like that matches your politics. So there we go. It didn't take long. Thank you for sharing this time with me. I'm always very grateful. I can go on and on and on. Don't have to hit those commercial breaks, which is something I often say at the end of the show. If you would like to subscribe, Apple iTunes is one good place to do it because you don't get the ads. You just get my voice. And my voice is about to sign off. See you tomorrow with more BuzzMeter. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts and via Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on Amazon Music.
Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.